Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Fair Sentencing Act and Retroactivity Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On April 17, 2012, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Dorsey v. United States and Hill v. United States. Both cases involve the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010, which dramatically increased the quantities of crack cocaine that must be involved in various drug trafficking offenses before certain mandatory minimum penalties will be triggered. The question in Dorsey v. United States is whether the Fair Sentencing Act applies to all defendants after its enactment, even if their crime and conviction occurred prior to its passage. The analogous question in Hill v. United States is whether the relevant date for determining the applicability of the Fair Sentencing Act is the date of the underlying offense or the actual date of sentencing. To discuss the cases, we have William Otis, who is an adjunct professor at Georgetown University Law Center and a former federal prosecutor. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Otis.
Last Tuesday, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in two cases about the Fair Sentencing Act. The cases are Dorsey and Hill. In August 2010, the President signed the Fair Sentencing Act into law. That act reduces the penalties for crack cocaine by raising the amount a defendant must be involved with in order to get a mandatory minimum sentence. The defendants of these cases committed their crack-related offenses before the act became law, but were sentenced afterward. So the question before the court was whether they should have received the benefit of the lowered sentences under the Fair Sentencing Act. Under a long pre-existing federal law called the General Savings Statute, the lowered sentences would appear to be inapplicable to offenses committed before the act was signed, and the lower court in Dorsey, the Seventh Circuit, so held, as had at least two other courts of appeals. But three other courts of appeals held the opposite, taking the view that once Congress found the prior crack penalties to be excessive, unjust, and perhaps racially discriminatory, it would be perverse to require judges to continue to use them, perhaps for 3, 4, 5 years into the future. The Supreme Court took the case to resolve that conflict. One thing that was striking about the oral argument in the case is it came in two very different segments. Now, you will sometimes see that because questioning to one party is obviously going to be different in its tenor from the questioning to the opposing party, which will then follow after the first party's argument is done. But it was particularly pronounced in this case. The judgment of the Seventh Circuit had been abandoned by the Department of Justice, even though it initially asked for it. The Department of Justice kind of changed horses in midstream. It had previously taken the position, and had taken the position in the Court of Appeals, that the savings statute was controlling here, and that crack defendants would not get the benefit of retroactive imposition of these lighter sentences. That was not the position it took in the Supreme Court. It abandoned its victories below and argued, along with the defendant, that there should be retroactive application. The court had to appoint an amicus, Miguel Estrada, to defend the judgment of the Seventh Circuit. There were two things that struck me about the oral argument. One was that the court spent a good deal of time talking about inconsistency with the results that the Fair Sentencing Act essentially required the Sentencing Commission to impose, and the cliffs that would result from mandatory minimum sentences on the one hand and sentencing guideline sentences on the other. The reason it struck me is that any ruling on retroactivity is, in a sense, going to permit inconsistency. It's going to have arbitrary lines about one defendant falling just inside the change and one defendant falling outside. So for the government, again, along with the defendants in these cases, to say that there was going to be inconsistency unless there was retroactive application struck me as a somewhat empty argument, because there's going to be inconsistency in any event. Another thing that struck me is how little both the court and the government had to say about the fact that inconsistency with guideline sentencing is really something of an illusion. It would have been the case if the guidelines had continued to be mandatory rather than advisory. But under a 2006 ruling, Booker, and the progeny of Booker, in particular Gall and Kimbrough, sentencing guidelines are now only advisory, and judges were specifically set free to adjust crack sentencing irrespective of congressional policy. The judges were set free to impose crack sentencing as they may be best advised once they took the guidelines and congressional policy at least into account. That being the case, it strikes me in a sense that the argument was much ado about nothing. With advisory guidelines, sentencing is kind of back to no man's land anyway, where you have an advisory sentencing system, that is to say a discretion-driven system rather than a rules-driven system. It's Katie bar the door. And in addition to that, appellate review of sentencing, and particularly of crack sentencing, has been made a great deal more difficult because courts of appeals have been instructed by Booker and its progeny to be a great deal more deferential to whatever the district court decides. In addition to that, I thought the other thing that stood out in this argument was the discussion of the racial impact of these sentences. This in particular seemed to be Justice Sotomayor's main point. Justice Sotomayor was taking the view that the crack sentencing that was changed by the Fair Sentencing Act was racially disparate. And that's true, and there had been a great deal of criticism among academics anyway of the racially disparate character of sentencing for crack. But what was absent from Justice Sotomayor's questioning was any assertion that the racial difference was intentional. And it has always been the law that unless racial differences are intentionally introduced to the law, disparate treatment in and of itself is not a constitutional violation. And this was in particular something that struck me. Neither the justices nor any of the counsel on either side pointed out that crack sentences, even under the old system, under which the ratio was 100-1 rather than the 18-1 that it is now under the Fair Sentencing Act, even under the old, harsher system, no court of appeals and neither the Supreme Court either had found that the difference in the disparate treatment of blacks and whites as a practical matter was a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. That being the case, it struck me as being more a question of policy than of constitutional law whether the new system, even though it would continue to punish those who have committed crack offenses, who again are disproportionately black, the fact that it would continue to punish them more harshly than those involved in powder cocaine, it struck me as the courts getting into policy questions rather than constitutional questions. And the third thing that struck me about the argument was kind of the elephant in the room. The elephant in the room was the savings statute. And for whatever one may think, racial differences and the amount of complaining about racial differences that has gone on, the savings statute in which Congress rejected, and this was an 1871 statute, and Congress rejected what had been the common law, which is would, the common law result would have been that defendants do get the benefit of new sentencing. The savings statute rejected that and said that defendants, unless there is an express provision in the new law providing for lighter sentences, absent an express provision, an express word used in the statute, absent that, sentences were to be given based on when the defendant committed the crime and not on the adventitious factor of when the defendant is sentenced. When the defendant is sentenced is something, after all, that the defendant does not choose. It's something that's chosen essentially by court procedures. The only thing a defendant chooses is when he commits the crime. So in that sense, it does seem to me that there is a fairness element inherent in the savings statute. But particularly as respects this argument, the idea that the savings statute should simply be overcome on the theory that Congress, in adopting the Fair Sentencing Act, found that the prior penalties had been unfair, unjust, excessive, and racially disparate. Well, whenever Congress lowers penalties with the new statute, that must reflect a finding that the old penalties were exactly that, unfair, unjust, and, as is often the case, would be applied more harshly to blacks, since everyone knows that blacks are disproportionately in the criminal justice system to a considerably greater extent than whites. Justice Sotomayor seemed to understand that, and there's one question of hers that I want to quote in particular. She asked the government's attorney, Michael Dreeben, who is the Deputy Solicitor General, this: "Mr. Dreeben, almost any law that repeals a prior penalty is doing so because the legislature determines that the prior penalty is unjust in some way. Because why do you eliminate a penalty unless you think it is necessary to do so and that it's unjust in some way? So what makes this repeal particularly different so that the exception doesn't swallow the rule? Because you can argue in almost any situation that the repeal is something that's just unjust." That's what Justice Sotomayor said. Now, later on in the argument, she seemed very much to be of the view that this was a different sort of thing because of the racially disparate impact on blacks. But I thought she made the better point in asking the question I have just quoted. If defendants, black or white, who are accused in crack cases and convicted in crack cases, are to get the benefit of the new lighter penalties in derogation of the savings statute, there must be some particular reason for that to be the case, some particular reason that Congress did not consider when it adopted the savings statute. And of course, Congress is presumed to adopt future statutes in light of and in the knowledge of prior statutes, which is to say that Congress must have adopted the Fair Sentencing Act in the knowledge of the savings statute, which had been on the books for years and years. Given that, one has to wonder why Congress did not make an express provision for retroactive application of its lighter sentences if it had so intended. And beyond that, although I don't think this next argument is something the Supreme Court could properly consider, one must ask as a policy matter why Congress has not addressed this problem that has split the Court of Appeals in the almost 2 years since the problem came up. That is, if Congress really did intend the lighter penalties to have retroactive application at any time in the last 2 years after President Obama signed the Fair Sentencing Act, it could have simply added one sentence to that act to the effect that the penalties provided herein shall be available at the time of sentencing, regardless of when the defendant committed his offense. Its failure to do so, it seems to me, undercut the defendant's argument and the government's argument in having abandoned its victory that the savings statute does not apply. It's very difficult for me to tell how this case is going to come out. It seemed to me that the four liberals were pretty much on the defendant's side. It also seemed to me that the four conservatives were pretty much on the government side, and that, as is so often the case, and as many people think is the case with the Affordable Care Act, this one is going to rest with Justice Kennedy. Justice Kennedy has a long history in criminal cases. As a matter of fact, he's given addresses before the ABA saying that our sentences are too harsh, they're excessive, certainly compared with those given in other parts of the industrialized world. He has also had, from a pro-law enforcement point of view, a bad term on criminal law cases, particularly in the Lafler case that found that effective assistance of counsel was applicable to the plea bargaining stage, even where the government did not participate or bring about the defense counsel's ineffective or mistaken actions. If one believes, as I do, that Justice Kennedy is seeing things more in the defendant's way, I think it's likely that the Fair Sentencing Act will be found retroactive, although I would not bet a whole lot on either outcome.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.